I used to think it
should. Right, Cabinet today has agreed to release the latest version of the New Zealand Influenza Pandemic Action Plan. There's been 18 months of work on these plans going on from the Ministry of Health, and they're now up to version 16, fully consulted on. Let's hope it never happens. We've agreed to the release of the consultation document to go out on the review of the regulation of alcohol advertising. Damien O'Connor's in charge of that one. We've begun considering a series of papers we're expecting coming up to the Cabinet committees in the next few weeks on climate change policy initiatives. That process has been overseen by Parker. And we are looking at policy papers around the review of the Māori trustee. We've made decisions around the design concept for the new Supreme Court building and the restoration of the old High Court, and I understand Rick Barker intends to do a presentation on that during the recess that's coming up. On Saturday, there's a major recreation summit being held in Wellington, and Chris Carter will release there the work Doc has done on reviewing the availability of camping sites in New Zealand. Each summer, there's been some focus in recent years on the disappearing private campground as coastal property becomes very valuable and people sell for development rather than camping opportunities. So Doc has done a review of that and has some proposals on how to go ahead, and there will be public feedback called for on that. We've agreed to release a discussion document on encouraging the uptake of transport biofuels, and the document is around a biofuels sales obligation. And Judith Tizard will have an announcement to make about that and her associate transport capacity. We've taken policy decisions on the review of the Residential Tenancies Act 1986. That's in Clayton Cosgrove's area of responsibility. And the aim is to have legislation introduced by the end of the year. We've also agreed on a position on ocean bottom trawling for New Zealand representatives to take at the range of regional and international meetings which are coming up in the next few months, from local ones in the Pacific, at the Regional Fisheries Management Organisation meeting and at the UN, and there will be an announcement coming out about that from the relevant ministers of Foreign Affairs, Conservation and Fisheries. And we've also agreed to release the action plan for 06-07 on the New Zealand Positive Ageing and Strategy. Now, coming up in the House this week, there are three bills which the government would like to progress to third readings. The Te Aroa Lakes Settlement Bill, which is a very important treaty settlement bill, obviously. There's also the Child Support Amendment Bill and the Standards and Conformance Bill, which is ready to go through. Announcements are coming up. David Benson Pope's asked me to foreshadow a range of events and happenings around the early intervention, family violence prevention and youth initiatives, particularly focusing on some of the troubled youth issues which have been bedeviling southern Auckland suburbs. This coming Wednesday there is a meeting scheduled of the multi-party group on family violence prevention. Coming up next Monday there will be an announcement of funding for early intervention in the early years. Probably Tuesday next week there will be launch of a significant action plan around initiatives to deal with the youth gang issues in the Otahuhu County's Manukau area. And then following through with other announcements around Family Start and Vulnerable Families initiatives. So that carries us through from the meeting this Wednesday of the multi-party group to arrange for initiatives to be announced in the recess week. Otherwise, coming up this week, there are important speeches, Parker on Electricity Wednesday, the Asia New Zealand Summit on New Zealand policy, New Zealand Inc. policy towards Asia on Thursday is being held. Steve Mahara will be announcing funding around ICT professional development for Auckland schools. There will be announcements later in the week about a planned review of sections of the Commerce Act from Leanne Dalziel and David Parker. Come Friday, there will be a formal commemoration at 10:30 at the National War Memorial of the 90th anniversary of the Battle of the Somme. It is the 90th anniversary of New Zealand committing to that battle. Next Monday, there will not be a cabinet. There's the WHO conference opening in Auckland, which I'm committed to speak at, and another significant event, so ministers won't be around for meetings next Monday. Next Monday, Winston Peters goes up to New York for the UN General Assembly, and then through to Europe for the six-monthly consultation with the EU presidency. And come Thursday next week, we're working on a launch around policy initiatives on what we're calling child and youth lifestyles, aiming at having fitter, less weighty, more healthy children and young people to head off the diabetes epidemic and other health problems associated with overweight. Now, I wanted to say a word on the arrangements around the death of the King Tonga, and first to note that we have extended our condolences from the Governor General through to Crown Prince, who steps up to his father's position, and from me to the Tongan Prime Minister. The King has been very well known to us over many years. I personally treasure the memory of the time he came to visit me in my office when I had not long been Prime Minister. He said he recalled coming to see David Longie there when he was Prime Minister. It was his first visit in many, many years to the office. He's been King for 41 years, which is a very, very long reign. He's lived to a great age, but his death will be a cause of great sorrow in Tonga. I think that the step the King took earlier this year in appointing Dr. Savelli as Prime Minister ensures that there will be a transition in Tonga, which is a constructive one, and we can expect to see more constitutional change in Tonga flowing out of that orderly transition to a commoner holding the position of Prime Minister. With respect to the arrangements now, the King's body is expected to lie in state at the Tongan Royal Residence in Epsom, and that will occur until the body is transported back to Tonga on Wednesday. I expect to go to pay my respects tomorrow at the residence. The New Zealand Air Force will be transporting the King's casket and members of the Royal Family to Tonga on Wednesday, departing at 10:30 from Whenuakai, as currently planned. There will be a 100-man Royal Guard at Whenuakai, and there will be a farewell ceremony conducted here on Wednesday morning. The exact date of the funeral is yet to be determined. The best estimate is anywhere from Saturday through to mid next week. So we await advice of that. New Zealand Air Force 757 will go up to Tonga, taking dignitaries from New Zealand, led, I hope, by the Governor-General, and members of New Zealand's Pacific communities who wish to pay their respects. There will, of course, be room for media, and it is expected to be a rather long day with an early departure to Tonga and returning later in the day. There has been a lot of discussion with the Tongan officials over a number of months about arrangements because the King's health has been indifferent for rather a long time now. Any questions?
Minister, the supposed brethren have accused you of indulging in hate speech over some comments you made about it recently. Do you have any response to that?
My response is that the exclusive brethren weighed into the election campaign in a way which exhibited a good deal of hate towards me, the Labor Party and the Green Party. It seems they can dish it out in a pretty anonymous fashion until exposed, but they can't take it.
Are you interested by media reports that suggest that they're intending on doing the same thing in 2008? And is there anything that Labor will do differently to stop them next time?
Clearly, I've signalled in the course of the last week that Labor is looking very seriously at major campaign financing reform and reform around what is regarded as attributable expenditure. And we would expect that it will not be easy for the exclusive brethren to mount the kind of campaign they did last time.
Why are you looking at that issue now?
Why? Because the National Party drove a bulldozer through the intent and spirit of the law. When you have the exclusive brethren going to the chief electoral officer and saying, we have a $1.2 million war chest we want to spend to help the re-election of the National Party, but please help us do it in a way which isn't attributable, that clearly breaks the intent and spirit of the law. So third-party advertising and promotion is something that now has to be very, very seriously examined. I might say, before someone puts the question, that with respect to the relatively minor amount of money by comparison which unions spent supporting the Labor Party, that money was attributed and accounted for in our election return.
Did Labor actually follow due process in the sense that they did take a pamphlet to the chief electoral officer that in the initial draft had a picture of Don Brash identified with the National Party, and as a consequence of advice from David Henry then their campaign in that way? So in that sense, they follow the process as required by the law?
What has been exposed by their behaviour is that there are loopholes in the law which people like the National Party and the Exclusive Brethren can drive a bulldozer right through. The reason for having campaign spending limits for political parties is precisely to stop big money manipulating election campaigns. The Brethren, as a third party, tried to anonymously, and were exposed, spend $1.2 million over that cap on the National Party to support its election. That is why these issues have to have the full attention of Parliament so they can be changed.
So are you looking at making negative campaigning attributable? Because that's basically how the Brethren's got around it.
That's how they got around it, and what we have to ensure is that when we set as a parliament, caps on what can be spent in a campaign period, but those caps are comprehensive and don't allow smear campaigning against opponents not to be attributable.
Who would carry out this review, or how would the review of the
A Justice Department officials who advise on policy on the Electoral Act are working on it as we speak, and obviously taking a close interest in what happens in other like countries like Australia.
What would you say to those who say that we do live in a democracy and there should be nothing to stop people like a group like the Exclusive Brethren, or indeed big business Labor of 1999, from campaigning on behalf of the party?
What I say is that we're at a turning point in New Zealand politics. We're at a turning point as to whether we want wealthy interests to drive a bulldozer through the spending limits on election campaigns in this country, or whether we're going to let wealthy interests dictate the outcome. It was very clear from the last election campaign that the National Party had a huge war chest. From the time the billboards went up, either they were foolishly spending the money they had within the campaign limit early and leaving themselves short, or they had an enormous amount of money. And that billboard expenditure was largely outside the campaign period. So the question is whether Kiwis want their politics manipulated by wealthy interests or whether they want a level playing field. And I think the fair play instinct of New Zealanders suggests that a level playing field is the way to go.
There have obviously been issues around campaign spending, not just for this election. Isn't this really just a distraction in terms of the reform from Labor's own problems with election spending?
The issue of dodging spending caps, as the National Party did through its exclusive growth and friends, and the early expenditure outside the campaign period on billboards goes to the very heart of democracy in New Zealand. Do you want wealthy interests to dominate your election campaigns, or do you want a more level playing ground? That's why I say we're at a turning point in New Zealand politics, and that is why Parliament has to grapple with these issues.
So you have good Christmas back in 99, probably more so than National. Do you agree with that? What was wrong with that?
I know that corporates have always donated to political parties, and there's been a sense of fair play in the past where people have given to support the democratic process intended to be relatively even-handed. But I think we're in an era now where it is extremely lopsided and where money is being channeled into secret funds on a scale that is quite extraordinary, when 92% of the National Party's funding cannot be traced. There is a problem, and I think it's time that problem was dealt with.
Are you dealing with the problem of the secrecy, though, or the problem that the Nats are simply attracting more money than Labor?
We're dealing with the issue of secrecy. So if you know who pays, then the public and media can have a much more informed interest in what the consequences of paying might be with respect to policy. We're also dealing with the ability to dodge spending caps, and spending caps have always been in the law, but ways clearly have been found through the exclusive brethren and upfront early funding to dodge those caps. As I say, you can have elections which are manipulated by huge money on one side, or you can go for a level playing field, and I prefer the level playing field.
Well, your changes also clarify whether spending on the things like the election, the pledge card, should be included as election spending?
Well, the issue is what is attributable, and the chief electoral officer came down with a ruling which said that what the brethren did wasn't, but the pledge card, which did not invite people to vote Labor explicitly, any more than the brethren leaflets invited people to vote National, he took a different view on the attributability of that. So I think we have to have another good look at the law and what the definition of attributability is.
But the timing is questionable, given that Labor is, you know, launching on this great reform suddenly at a time when the party is under scrutiny for its own election spending.
I can assure you that we have, for a number of months now, had Minister Mark Burton looking at these issues. What has caused us to announce what we're doing is quite gross behaviour by the National Party in terms of throwing around terms which I don't believe should be used about transparent use of parliamentary funding. And that's why I say the real corruption in New Zealand politics arises if you have wealthy interests able to manipulate elections. And there's every indication that that is what they attempted last year through the National Party.
What do you think the exclusive brethren...
Oh, months ago. Many, many months ago. I couldn't give a day off the top of my head, but it has been many months ago.
What do you think the exclusive brethren saw was in it for them by canvassing, I guess, in a vicarious way for the National Party, other than getting rid of your government?
Well, that seemed to be their prime motivation. They managed to get Don Brash to change his vote on the Civil Union Bill. He was all for that prior to the election period. Who knows what else they were looking for. They've never liked employment law, which gives a more level playing field for ordinary people to advance their interests. There could have been all sorts of things that they hoped they might gain from it. But at base, I suspect that they are simply extremely right-wing people who don't like a Labor government. And I think there's a bit of desperation about a lot of the attacks on the government at the moment from right-wing people who see three election losses in a row and are getting hysterical about it.
Is it always the case that the cash goes for a reason? I mean, what did Owen Dean gave, I think, $500,000 to that to be last
week? Yes, up front, accounted for fully by the Labor Party. And I don't believe he asked for a single thing. He said he didn't get anything.
So he just gave it for...
Yes, he did. He liked what we stood for. He liked what we stood for.
Is that any different from cash for policy, as you're saying?
Well, I think it's very different from having a policy which offers billions of dollars of income to insurance companies and then not being prepared to say how much money you've got from those companies.
So if interest groups are open about where they're coming from, they're okay to run these sort of campaigns?
No, come back to the issue. We set spending caps in electoral law in New Zealand. And the exclusive brethren spent right outside that camp, within the campaign period, as you know. That is why the law has to focus on the issue. In addition, the ability of a party like the National Party, which promises privatisation and a great deal of benefit to wealthy interests, to attract very large sums of money and spend in a large way, not just in 3-month period, but beyond that, also raises considerable issues of fairness, which is why I say it drives a bulldozer through the intent and spirit of electoral law.
But isn't it true that Labor also spent outside spending caps? So doesn't that put you on a par?
Well, we don't believe we did spend on attributable matters outside the cap. And certainly the matters which are now being raised have never been considered outside, inside the cap before. It has not been considered attributable expenditure.
Last week, the Foreign Affairs Minister returned back to work, but he seemed a bit reluctant to tell us how he's been getting on. Has he given you a briefing at all on his health?
I actually haven't had the opportunity to talk to him in the last few days, but I would say people are entitled to keep their personal health issues to themselves. Some people are more private than others, and not everyone wants every detail about their personal condition on the front page of the paper.
Well, not when it affects his job, which it obviously has done, hasn't it?
Well, you know, in the course of being Prime Minister, I've had many ministers sick. Some have been away for a month, 2 months, 3 months even. And, of course, you always are very, very sympathetic to that. My attitude is that if people are unwell, they should not be at work. That's a good principle. You know, it's then up to the individual how open they wish to be about that.
Are you confident that he's able to keep going, though? He's got quite a rigorous travel program coming up in the next month or so. I mean, have you reassured yourself that he's fit to do the job, basically, which I guess is what's at the heart of a lot of the questions?
Well, at the end of the day, he'll act on the advice of his doctor, but I understand he's got every intention of getting on a plane at the start of next week and going to New York for the UN General Assembly, and then on to Finland for the 6-monthly EU presidency consultation. So that sounds like considerable confidence in itself.
2 or 3 weeks ago in the House, Phil Collins said that when Mr. Peters returned, he would be revealing some emails about Dr. Brash and John Key. Do you know whether we're going to get those before he goes to the UN?
I have no idea.
You seemed to hint that last week that there were emails coming along that line.
It's understood there is more information, but I'm not better informed beyond that.
So does Labor have anything to do with the emails?
No.
Except it knows about them?
Well, it knows that there are emails. That's as far as it goes.
Any further evidence of this idea of cash for policy? Do you have any more information about the public arenas to prove that?
As I say, if the National Party opened its accounts, it would be very interesting, and we could all evaluate. As I said to you last week, insurance companies which have in the past, we understand, have been more even-handed, certainly did not contribute to the Labor Party last time. And at the time that we proposed bringing all worker compensation back under the social insurance scheme, the ACC, expressed a grave displeasure in opposition to that.
Last week, the minor parties seemed to suggest they were going to conduct some form of walkout for these students. Simon's made that. What did you make of your comments?
Well, the first I heard of the comments was when I heard them on the media later that day. It seems to me that there has been a concerted barracking and barraging of me as Prime Minister in the House for many, many months, and I'm sorry people didn't take their position earlier. A little surprised at the level of coverage of the noise in the House over the last week, because you will have observed that for many months, when I have risen to answer questions, there has been an attempt to shut me down. And that, I can only assume, is an attempt to cover for Dr. Brash's inadequacies in Parliament, to try to ensure that the Prime Minister, in this case myself, cannot be heard. So the bad behaviour is not a feature of the last week. It has been going on for rather a long time.
Trevor Mallard, though, last week made several personal comments across the chamber to individual MPs. What did you think of him doing that? Do you condone his contact?
I'm thinking of asking the Minister of Police for a taser gun for Trevor.
You promised to use
it. I might need some instruction.
Just points of shoot.
Prime Minister, 5 years on from 9/11, what's your take on the real situation vis-à-vis security? Is it more secure?
No, we're not more secure since 9/11. 9/11 was a new era because it showed the ability of terrorists to strike at the very heart of the most powerful nation on earth. And that was a very, very sobering thought. It was not a new phenomenon, and the British people have experienced terrorism for many years with the Irish Republican Army in the past. And I remember first going to Britain as a young person in 1976 and being shocked coming from New Zealand at having to leave bags and at the entrance to museums and other public buildings. In fact, almost anywhere one went, one had those sorts of searches. So that was new to us. Of course, before 9/11, Osama bin Laden's people had struck. They struck at the USS Cole in the Gulf. They struck at the embassies of the United States in both Nairobi and Dar es Salaam. But 9/11 was an escalation. And there's been many other terrible such events since. Now, the international community has reacted, and New Zealand has been very keen to be seen to comply in full with all the international conventions and protocols which the UN and other international organisations like ICAO for civil aviation and International Maritime Organisation for Shipping Trade have introduced. We've also played our part in trying to stabilise Afghanistan. But as I've said from the outset of this new era in terrorism and combating, there are some things you can do through military means, there are some things you can do through clamping down on financial transfers for terrorist organisations. There's a lot you can do through diplomacy. But in the end, we also need to be taking seriously efforts to engage across civilisations and faiths. And so New Zealand has also pursued quite an active diplomatic course with respect to interfaith dialogue and reaching out to moderate states and leaders in the Islamic world, because we feel that even a small Western nation like New Zealand can play a part in encouraging more understanding between people.
So you're saying that we're no safer since 9/11, because it's been 5 years since Operation Enduring Freedom that we participated in at that time. Do you think that that's made any difference?
Well, the operation in Afghanistan drove Al-Qaeda out of Afghanistan. But Al-Qaeda is a hydra-headed beast. Al-Qaeda manifests itself in small cells in many places. And we've seen really appalling bombings and events in so many places from people who respond to that particular call.
So there's a bit of a hopeless cause of war on terrorism.
I think that you have to deal with these issues on many, many levels, and New Zealand has dealt with them on many, many levels. Being part of the effort that drove Al-Qaeda out of Afghanistan, be part of trying to bring greater security and stability to Barmian province, the diplomatic engagement and outreach which we've had. But it's a very, very complex issue. And at home, it's made us particularly mindful of the need to work very hard on social cohesion and inclusion here, so that we don't have younger generations of emerging communities who feel alienated and estranged from our country. It's one of many reasons why you'll see my normal weekend program in Auckland engaging very, very widely with a huge range of ethnic communities. On Saturday night, for example, I ended up at about 10:30 at Ethiopian New Year. Another weekend it might be the Prophet Muhammad's birthday, or the end of the Eid celebrations. It might be Diwali, it might be all kinds of things. But we're working very hard to try and set that tone of acceptance, inclusion, tolerance, cohesion here in New Zealand.
Is there, though, there are some people who would argue that the West's response to the 9/11 attacks, particularly the US and Britain's invasion of Iraq, have actually made it worse, though, and made the terrorism situation worse?
Well, firstly, I think the immediate response with respect to Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan was absolutely right. And we have stayed on in Afghanistan in a different capacity now, 3 years with the provincial reconstruction team. And we get nothing but praise from local people for that. And there's also some pride in seeing Barmian province as the first to have a woman governor, for example. So I'm very, very happy with the job that's being done there. But you will recall at the time of huge debate around the intervention in Iraq, that one of the things I said was that my concern was that that intervention would make the world less safe from terrorism rather than more safe. And Iraq was not a haven for terrorists prior to the war there. It certainly is now.
Do you feel that's been borne out, that fear?
Unfortunately, it has been borne out, but it's one of a number of issues, and a long-standing one, which, if tackled, would make a real difference, is the Israeli-Palestinian dispute. If you could get a peace settlement of two states on secure boundaries, each recognising the other, that would do a tremendous amount to relieve tension in the Middle East.
Prime Minister, the government's position on ocean trawling, does that extend to a call for a global moratorium?
Well, I'll leave it to the Minister's concern to make the statement, but there's quite a comprehensive position that we've agreed on, and that will be the position we take to the General Assembly, the Regional Fisheries Management Organisation, the Pacific Island Forum, and so on.
Have you sent any letters or messages to Tony Blair lately?
No, but I'm looking forward to having breakfast with him in London on the 10th of November.
Is he giving you good lessons on how not to do it?
Well, I think that it's quite unusual to announce before an election that if you win, you don't intend to contest the next one. And that's really the series of events which are playing out now.
Do you agree with the commentators who say that it's his alliance with George Bush and Barack that has been his?
Well, firstly, I think that Tony Blair's Labor government has done a tremendous amount for Britain. I think in terms of equality, inequality issues, raising living standards for people, the money they've poured into their basic public services has been absolutely terrific. But obviously, for foreign policy has been controversial. You know, that's been their choice. We made other choices. But that's certainly caused a lot of pain for the British government on a number of occasions.
Yeah. Try.